25 years ago today, on April 15, 1949, at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Lewis Hill stepped before a microphone in Berkeley, California, and said for the first time, quote, "This is KPFA, listener-sponsored radio in Berkeley." Thus began a brash experiment that has survived and grown for over 25 years. This program is intended as a celebration of this improbable anniversary, as a tribute to the sacrifices made by the founders of KPFA, especially Lewis Hill. It is also a way for us to say thanks to you, the subscribers, who have continued to pay and pay for what you could have heard for free. And finally, this program is intended as a means of getting back to our roots. KPFA Interim was put on the air for a grand cost of $11,262.80, mostly with used or surplus parts and donated labor. Eleanor McKinney, KPFA's first program director, recalls the feeling of that day 25 years ago.
It was typical of Pacifica, perhaps now as well as then. The carpets were being laid up to about 5 minutes till three. And testing, of course, had been done in advance, and we found it sort of miraculous to be at our homes in advance in this actual sound of KPFA with an engineer saying testing on the air. Somehow when we were doing it, it just never seemed real that it would occur like that. You could go home and turn on your set and there it would be. But at 3 o'clock, just with the last hammering of the carpenters fading in the distance and everybody sort of rushing to their desk and being unconcerned, Lou went on the air and said, "This is KPFA, this is our first day on the air," and started describing something about it. And of course, the emotional ones among us were full of tears, and it was a turning point at the end of, I think, three preliminary years of working for it. So it was quite a day.
And there were no technical problems? It just went?
Well, there were always technical problems. I don't remember how many hours we were on the air, and something went wrong with the transmitter, and we had to go off and work on that some more.
The biggest problem we had was the fact that we were on the sixth floor and we didn't have very good ground.
Ed Meese, KPFA's first chief engineer.
The Western Electric console was not particularly well adapted to operate in high RF fields.
It's still a problem at KPFA. We still have to bypass and feed through everything.
So the first time we put the thing on the air as for a test, fed a normal level into the transmitter, and we got RF feedback, which caused the modulation to go wild, and we had open wire transmission line going from the transmitter up through the ceiling, through the roof. We put about a 40-foot tower on top of the building and put a 4-bay open wire turnstile antenna on top of that, and I could just barely pick it up on Broadway in Oakland with an old pilot tuner. But the reason that we were able to survive in that situation, I think, by the things that happened later, was the fact that the most fertile area for listeners was, of course, the Berkeley Hills, and we did have a good signal into the Berkeley Hills because the hills would rise gently away from the transmitter.
How much power did you run then?
The 250-watt transmitter with a 4-bay antenna was roughly, theoretically, a kilowatt.
And Ed Meese, the engineer, had put the transmitter together.
Eleanor McKinney.
And was working on the roof and had some problems with it. And again, sort of typical of Pacifica, when you're in need, somebody comes in and helps you. And this was one of those strange stories. Ed was up there with people working on the transmitter on a small tower, and some engineer was walking by on University Avenue and happened to see it. and was so intrigued he came up, and it turned out he had exactly the skill that was needed to solve some problem that Ed had.
Tell me a little bit about the beginning and the genesis of it. How did it happen to start?
Well, most of all, it started because we were in radio, Lou and I, and we were unhappy in radio.
Joy Cole Hill.
And I suppose, like everybody else, we daydreamed about our own ideal radio station. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized that nobody would pay for it because advertisers, we'd be talking to a minority, you know, and advertisers are very unfond of minorities. They like the largest possible body count for their dollar. We went into the whole idea of co-op radio as a possibility in the beginning, and discovered that this was not legally possible. Things that go out on airwaves don't classify as products, and you got to have a product to have a co-op to market it. So the only thing that seemed to be left was the idea that perhaps people who would also be interested in this would pay for it. There were lots of incredible people, just incredible people, who said, yes, I'll do what I can do, you know, whether it was $100 or $500 or $1,000. And it added up very, very slowly. And we finally, of course, reached a point where it was going to be a matter of, are we going to eat or aren't we going to eat? And we had to tell them, look, two-thirds of this will go into the escrow fund, and the rest of it's going to keep us alive in the meantime, if you don't mind, because we do have engineers and people who are working and do have families to support. And even this was acceptable. So there was a long, long period, probably 3 years at least, of change in shape and change in personnel. And the ones who were tough enough, I guess, and who were convinced enough or crazy enough or something, stuck it out. And most of all, I think we had volunteers. And I don't think anybody can ever say how much the volunteers meant to us or meant to KPFA and its just sheer existence. Sometimes there were 10 or 15 or 20 people up there at a time just doing the little routine clerical and not so little clerical chores that had to be done. It would never, ever have gotten off the ground if these people had not cared passionately about it. I think perhaps what KPFA or Pacifica, the group, needs to ask itself is, why did they care? What was being delivered that made these listeners want so intensely to help? Not just to subscribe, but to literally put in hours and hours of their time and help. And help they did. They raised money, they put out folios, they sent out mailings, they swept the station, you know, literally everything. It would never have been possible without them. And the only reason I can think of was because they were hearing something that was alive and that they trusted, that had a kind of quality of integrity about it that just was so refreshing.
During the 8 years that I was at KPFA, I don't remember taking a single day off. I mean, 7 days a week.
Alan Rich, now a music critic for New York Magazine.
It never occurred to me to take a single day off because whatever I may have felt about individuals at the station, whatever hassles I may have felt, it had just gotten to the point where that was the only place where I really lived. It was like, you know, it was like those plants you buy in the 5 and 10 that when you take them out of water they dry up, and when you put them back into water they turn green overnight. To an awful lot of us in those days, first the Lou Hill crowd, which I say included people like Chuck Levy, Virginia Maynard, Eleanor McKinney, and all that, and the later, somewhat more responsible crowd like Elsa Thompson and people like that. It was just inconceivable that there was anything outside those walls. on Shattuck Avenue, as far as it was the medium in which we all lived.
I was thinking the other day about that very first day on the air. We had spent most of the night before at a kind of beer bash. Gotten a couple of cases of beer, and everybody we could recruit, everybody we knew, you know, came over, and we spent the evening in the really agonizing process of stuffing loose asbestos fibers into the back of the walls to soundproof the main studio. So everybody was a little spent the following morning anyhow, and so we went on the air, and Lou made a little speech sort of at the beginning, explaining what we were trying to do and asking anyone who heard us to call and comment both on the quality of the signal and anything they had to say on the programming. And he finished, and the first program got started. As I recall, Bill Triest was the first announcer, or Dick Moore. And the first program went on, and we sat there thinking something happened that wasn't intended, you know, some goof. And we kept saying, nobody's listening. There's nobody out there listening. And then it went on a little longer, and we began to be really afraid there was nobody out there listening. And all of a sudden, the phone rang, and some saintly gentleman called to tell us that we sounded great, and he was delighted to welcome us to Berkeley. And we just sat there in that control room, grinning. You could have lit up the whole room on the strength of those grins. Somebody listened.
You know, when you talk about the early days, there were all kinds of early days.
Bill Triest, KPFA's first chief announcer.
The spirit of the early meetings, I don't know, I think we met probably a couple of times a month, going back 1946, and drafting the Articles of Incorporation, deciding what kind of a radio station we wanted, whether we wanted a radio station at all, what it should do. Applying to the FCC for a channel. As a matter of fact, the original application, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact, was not for an FM station at all. It was for an AM station in Richmond. We went through long and complicated hearings and didn't make it. But certainly the, I don't know, that spirit of the, you know, from the time that the station went on the air, I don't know, there must have been a magnificent spirit during the period of construction. I wasn't that closely involved during the construction period, although I think I came over a good deal. But the first, year and 2 or 3 months, the period known as KQED Interim, I don't know. It's hard to describe the spirit. There weren't very many of us. There were a lot of volunteers. I think the staff consisted of about 7 people. We had, I think, a very healthy respect for that person in the audience. We also had, I think, a certain respect for one another and for ourselves. I don't know whether we thought it was going to last or not. We probably didn't. Each day was pretty exciting. We were engaged, as far as we knew, in a whole new kind of radio programming, not only in terms of its content, but also in its manner of presentation. Sounds, I guess, kind of romantic and silly, but as I recall, one of the first acts that we did when we got KPFA Interim on the air, I don't know, one of the first, but it was pretty early in the game, I think. At one point, we went in the studio and tore all the clocks off the walls. I mean, literally, we didn't want a clock there. And this is unheard of in radio. Certainly unheard of in radio is having programs fulfill themselves in terms of their content. We had an idea, usually, how long a program was going to last, but it was scheduled for a period of time, and if it was a little less or a little more, what difference did it make? What we were interested in is what the program had to say.
Okay, if you would just read through. This is Lou Hill's report on the first 5 months of operation. And just give us a flavor of some of the programs.
Well, then, Larry, as probably now, there were various categories of programs, and perhaps they're still the same. It was music programming, it was public affairs programming, there was drama, children's programs. Music programming, there was a great deal of, and Most of it was live. Then we had quite an impressive Meet the Composer and a Composer's Concert. These were weekly concerts and a tremendous number of extraordinary composers. Roger Sessions, Virgil Thompson, Darius Milhaud, Henry Cowell, Howard Brubeck, Ernst Bacon, George Baratti are just a few of the names that appeared on that. That happened every week. Huh? As I recall, our early programming, we went on the air in the afternoon, mostly with children's programs, and there were a lot of fine children's programs. And they were again, I think we were interested in kind of reform, maybe some of the same ideas that are still kicking around. Nonviolence, for one thing, but also broadening imaginations, broadening ideas. We had a magnificent storyteller, Joe Gardner, told stories in the oral tradition, and Jaime Dangulo came down, seemed at least from the Berkeley Hills, and told us Indian stories, Indian legends, and quite authentic about Fox Boy and Grandfather Coyote. I guess you've heard some of them. Then we had a good many nature programs, various things of that kind. In terms of our conviction or belief, or at least desire, that what we did should be listened to, at the very start, we went on the air, I think, at 4, 4.30 in the afternoon, but we signed off at 6, and we all went and had supper, and then came back again at 7.30. It was sort of a nice, convenient thing as far as the staff was concerned. It was small, and we were all there all day, and we wanted to eat. But it also, I think, partook of the idea that between 6 and 7.30, most households were engaged in other activities, and they weren't about to listen to what we had to offer, and we really wanted them to listen. So we programmed also for the convenience of the staff as well as the audience, and we knocked off for an hour and a half, and we all went and ate.
Marvelous. That's great. I've threatened on occasion to turn the station off when my replacement has been continuously late or not shown up, and I've never done it. And your little anecdote has given me courage.
We were talking about programs. Public affairs, we had all kinds of things. We had a KPFA roundtable. We had commentaries. We had a critics program. I forget what it was called. I'll find it in a moment. But some of the topics, for example, on the roundtable were, should rents be decontrolled in the Bay Area? Should labor build a third party now? Do our children have an adequate milk supply? Is the atomic age destroying our civil liberties? Ezra Pound, poetry and politics. Are co-ops unfair to American business? Are we headed for a depression? Conscientious objectors in the law. It goes on and on and on. Then we had a critic circle, and all kinds of topics there, from Horatio Alger to Superman, Al Capp and the Shmoo, women, the lost sex. Art and the Layman, influence of the Muckrakers, a discussion of Toynbee's history, the world of the salesman, censorship in the arts, George Orwell's 1984. Yeah, we might have been apolitical, but we certainly didn't dodge any issues. Then we had an interview program called Men and Issues, and boy, the list of that is quite impressive. People.
His is the voice of the 18th century man of reason, moderation and good sense, whose calm and lack of fear.
Virginia Maynard introduces Lewis Hill reading Jefferson's first inaugural address.
And here in his exact words is Jefferson's affirmation of political sincerity and idealism.
Friends and fellow citizens, called upon to undertake the duties of the first executive office of our country, I avail myself of the presence of that portion of my fellow citizens which is here assembled to express my grateful thanks for the favor with which they have been pleased to look toward me, to declare a sincere consciousness that the task is above my talents, and that I approach it with those anxious and awful presentiments which the greatness of the charge and the weakness of my powers so justly inspire.
Commentator series. We even had commentators in those early days. I don't know, we didn't have as many, but Tom Parkinson was one of the commentators, Gordon Haskell, as I recall, Delmar Brown, Clarence Russ, Bob Schutz, and others. And we had a challenge table in addition to all these things where We had challenges and we had challengers. And well, there's one here I just saw. O. John Rogge, the former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, and the discussion on can there be peace and freedom in our time. And he was challenged by a number of people. Howard Fast was on that, all kinds of people.
This was the mid-50s. Of course, it was after World War II. Now, this was, we're talking about 1949, 1950, and my days there ended in 54. These were the Army McCarthy hearings were going on, I think, around those days. First Amendment problems were quite prominent then. I remember some, really extraordinary programs done by Alexander Micheljohn.
The First Amendment seems to me to be a very uncompromising statement. It admits of no exceptions. It tells us that the Congress, and by implication all other agencies of the government, are denied any authority whatever to limit the political freedom of the citizens of this nation. It declares that with respect to political belief, political discussion, political advocacy, political planning, our citizens are sovereign, and the Congress is their subordinate agent.
Our greatest difficulty in those days, of course, was the risk that the Communist Party would take over.
Mrs. Lou Hill.
And we were constantly on guard against this. Whether it was a kind of paranoia is hard to say now. It certainly felt real enough. And there's no doubt that they were infiltrating labor unions and other groups at that time. And we did not want any suggestion to be made that this was in the control of or belonged to any single group. And that included the Democrats and the Republicans, as well as the Communists, and the Socialists, the Wobblies, or whoever else was out there. There was an enormous hassle over the first time we ever had Harry Bridges on. And we ran up against these communist charges over and over again. And they never stuck. And the reason they never stuck was because we weren't peddling anything except integrity, except an open mic and the opportunity to have your best spokesman for your viewpoint heard. We didn't ask anybody to believe it. How could they? We had five commentators from five different spectrums of political thinking, one a day, every week. There was no way you could listen to this and believe everything you heard or agree with everything you heard. No way, But what you could do was say, well, now, I haven't ever heard anybody say that before. I wonder if that's true. Maybe I better look into it. And Lou felt very strongly that this was the foundation stone of democracy and of this country. That unless you knew what was happening, what was being said, what was being proposed, if you didn't know this, you couldn't act on it. You couldn't even think intelligently about it, much less vote on it or write your congressman about it. No way. So this in essence is what we were trying to do was to provide a channel for the people that didn't have a channel so that they could say, we feel this way about what's happening in America. And the station itself did not take sides. We did our level best to get the best spokesman, the best, the most verbal, the most easily able to communicate person, which wasn't always simple with the Republican Party in those days. They distrusted us, and they knew that they were going to be up against questions, and it was quite often a problem to get a good spokesman. But we really did try. And on top of this, of course, we outproduced the entire network facilities in toto the very first year we were on the air in terms of live production. We had all kinds of exciting things going on, intellectually stimulating music, plays, talks, voice dramas, just readings of things, you know, all sorts of stuff. You never knew what you were going to find. It's just that the commitment really was to the individual and to... I hate to say this because it sounds so schmaltzy now. It's out of currency and everything else. But Lou cared very much about this country. He cared about the Constitution. He cared about individual conscience. And he felt that the basic commitment that we all made was to strengthening the country, and that it could not be strong if it couldn't listen. It needed to listen. It didn't necessarily need to act on everything, obviously. This, it seems to me, produces incessant fragmentization. We saw this in our own experience during World War II with the various pacifist groups, you know, that were working, and there was one on one floor and one on another floor and a third group on a third floor, and half the time they weren't speaking to each other, and the only thing they had in common was the addressograph machine and the little hand-cranked mimeograph in the basement. And they each one had its own jealously guarded mailing lists, and essentially they were talking to themselves continually. And this, it seems to me, is precisely what is happening now. Each movement, even though it starts with great reason and great validity, ends up splintering and splintering and splintering, and so you become more and more diverse and less effective. If what you were trying to do really is to change something. We weren't trying to change things. We were trying to say, hey man, this is the way it is. Look at it and listen to it. Because if it needs changing, you're the one that's going to change it. But you've got to know about it in order to change it. I think perhaps Lou's commitment, all of our commitment, was to America and to the Constitution. And I think that considering the appalling assault that is being made on the bedrock fundamental root of this country, that it's a very valid commitment today, too.
If 500,000 mothers went to Washington saying, bring all our boys home without delay, would the man they came to see say he was too busy? Would he say he had to watch a football game? Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board. Last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, last train to Nuremberg, all on board.
I understand that there was some idea of making it a commercial station, a commercial FM station. And in fact, Ed Meese told me there was at least one commercial on KPFA. It was a trade-out ad for the landlord.
Oh, yeah, certainly was. As a matter of fact, the original application was not for a non-commercial station at all. The original application was for an AM station, commercial, limited commercials, if you wish, very few, and restrained commercials. And I'm not absolutely certain when, I think it was Lou and probably Eleanor McKinney who had that real brainstorm of saying, well, let's be listener-sponsored. Didn't happen just like that, I don't think. But my memory says that KPFA Interim, when it went on the air in April of 1949, was not a non-commercial listener-sponsored station. In fact, I think there was even what is known as a rate card, which was printed. And the sad fact of the matter was that I think other than that one trade-out commercial for the landlord at 2054 University Avenue, I don't think we were successful in getting any other sponsors, so something had to be done.
One of the things that we had fun doing was in the idea that programs should come to their natural conclusion. And, you know, for example, if you're in the middle of an exciting roundtable discussion and somebody's just made a marvelous point and you're ready to take off again, it's just absurd on something as free as KPFA to stop it at the second. So but you have to start roughly on time for people. So those miscellany, we had periods at the end of programs, various things we had pre-planned to put in so that it would make up the last 10 minutes before the next hour, whatever time it ended. And one of our sort of games was everybody brought poems and stories and Chinese tales.
You arrived by the green, green maple trees and disappeared by the dark mountain pass. On the beams, the setting moon is shining. Your face seems to glimmer there in the light. Where you are, the waters are deep, waves wild. Beware, fall not to the river monsters.
Any number of little favorite private archives of material to put in those miscellany periods. And some of those were just delightful. And also the use of silence. If you heard a beautiful piece of music and you were going into something political or something very different, we would have moments of silence, 2 or 3 minutes. We would just say we're going to be quiet for a few minutes and let you recover or enjoy the last strains of that symphony before we begin. And the other thing that was a lot of fun after professional radio, where everything was so exact and there were all these things like due to technical problems beyond our control, etc., and we were determined never to use any of those terms, including never use such terms as that are commonly used in the news, the enemy. We referred to nations and peoples as what their names were, not as the enemy. None of the stereotypes that people become even mindless about and don't even notice they're using.
I'm happy to tell you that that tradition still remains. That was maintained all through the Vietnam War.
Very good.
We never thought of that we were talking to an audience. We thought we were talking to one person who happened to be listening. There were lots of ones, but in terms of where our head was that there's one. And if we reach that one, that's really reached them with some kind of meaningful communication. That was pretty satisfying.
It's safe to say that had there been no Lewis Hill, there would have been no Pacifica. Lou Hill was a complex Renaissance man, described by one and all as a genius, a difficult, driven perfectionist who is at once journalist, woodworker, tinkerer, empire builder, semantic scholar, musician, businessman, and poet. In 1957, after a series of protracted internecine conflicts at KPFA, and after a long, debilitating battle with spinal arthritis, Lou Hill took his own life. By this act, he transformed himself from Pacifica's Moses to KPFA's Christ. Who was Lou Hill? His friends, associates, his wife, and his son attempt a definition.
As a person, he had perhaps the thing you would have noticed most about him in the beginning was an extraordinarily articulate speech.
Eleanor McKinney.
Rather complex and brilliant in its insights. And I think one of the unusual mixtures about him was that he was basically a poet, but he was also very good in business and budgets and mimeograph machines, and those were combinations that are rather rare. There's usually a poetic quality that doesn't often get mixed with an awful lot of business ability and hard thinking. And he was deeply dedicated to excellence in all its forms. And, you know, it was maddening because a lot of us had had specialized skills in certain areas, and the mimeograph machine would break down, and it would be Lou, go fix it. Or we'd be assigned to do some kind of complicated business about filling it out FCC forms, and he knew how to do it. And that, of course, gave rise to an awful lot of, competitive spirit, aggravation. He was, I think, both deeply loved and deeply disliked by, depending on the person. Rather difficult to understand.
How would you characterize his personality? Was he aggressive or soft or pragmatic or dreamlike? What was he like?
I would think, again, it's whether first impression or after you got to know him. I think when people first met him, they were put off by his rather cold analytical mind that came out in his speech. But he had a marvelous sense of humor. I think he was basically a lonely person because he created such an image that many people didn't break through that image to find out what he was really like. But basically, he was a poet. He was warm, funny, talented. I think some people experience that kind of mind as an aggressive thing. And he had very strong opinions, indeed.
In my view, he was a very intelligent fellow.
Norman Jorgensen, KPFA's first FCC attorney.
He probably was so brilliant mentally that usually in discussions he was anywhere from 5 to 10 jumps ahead of you. And as such, a great many people found him difficult to deal with. He was brilliant enough so that he could almost anticipate where the conversation was going or whatever your discussion might be. I don't know what Lou Hill's effect was on other people, but he persuaded me to do it for nothing, and I think he inspired a lot of other people. For some reason or other, whatever it may be, however you may explain it, when he began to tell you of his plans and his project, you sort of caught fire with him, and you went right ahead with him, and you forgot all the other considerations that usually keep you moving. When he died, it was a great shock to me because, in my view, he's one of the greater men that I have met in my lifetime.
Thank you very much, and on behalf of several hundred thousand people who have subscribed to Pacifica over these 25 years, thanks a lot for doing it for nothing, and I hope you have been repaid in some tender.
Well, my recollections of Lou Hill are sufficient payment.
He had, among other qualities, the ability to extrapolate tomorrow's events from today's actions.
Mrs. Lewis Hill.
And it gave you the kind of peering around corners feeling at times when things worked out exactly as Lou had said 6 months ago, and you sort of tended sometimes to get your back up and think, she's not omnipotent, man, no. But even if it did seem almost that way.
Is there anything he couldn't do?
Yeah, he couldn't have babies. Or bake bread. But that he didn't try to do. But really, what it was an infinite ability to take pains. Lou was a perfectionist. This was partly his curse and partly his blessing. He did everything incredibly well. He worked with a degree of concentration over periods of time that I've never seen in anyone else. He had a personal family heritage of empire building, you might say, and some of the just the mechanics, the practical mechanics of making things happen could very well have come out of that heritage. But he was also a poet, you know, and a very sensitive, perceptive, deeply spiritual.
Berkeley, California, March 24, 1952.
Person.
Lewis Hill reading his poems. On the habit of visiting the beach at evening to resolve a disturbance. Water is not fathoms, but intense in the valleys, and quiet is nowhere like the water mountains. Water is not waste, but long in dark orchards, and substance is sometime like the water forest. The white sea plunges at the wind's intention, and the wind is leagues who devises the tempest, and who speaks the spray has the moon's commotion, and who walks the rock reaches has invention, as the dayfall has gray intelligences.
In a sense, it does Lou a disservice to create a mystique about him, I think, in spite of the fact that I've done it too, you know. He was perhaps the mainspring, but it was like a watch, you know. One cog doesn't make a watch. One man doesn't make a radio station.
He was not like the whole thing by any means.
Kit Hill, Lou Hill's son.
But I think what attracted a lot of people to him in the first place was that his heart was very open. It was not a heart that was closed and that wanted to impress the signature of its angers, feelings, and impressions on others, but rather that was open, that did want to listen.
You say that he shouldn't be mythified or apotheosized into the spirit of Pacifica, yet he has, independently of his friends and the people who were there, become at once a Moses and a Christ figure, and his death has very Christ-like overtones. One of the people at WBAI wrote a folio article in the depth of depression and frustration, and the article was entitled "Now I Know Why Lou Hill Committed Suicide." And this, there's a terrible cost to being part of Pacifica in a deep way. I've paid part of that. You've paid that, Lou paid that, and perhaps that's a large reason why it's survived, because people are willing to pay that. How much did it cost him?
Oh, anything you commit yourself to has a price in that sense.
You were talking about somebody wrote a folio article saying, "Now I know how Lou Hill felt," you know, and about the Christ figure and all the parallels and all that. It's so easy to focus on something very dramatic like that. And I think there's been an awful lot of martyrs and an awful lot of Christ figures, either in small ponds or medium-sized ponds or even big ponds, you know, from Kennedy and whoever on down for a long time now. But what Lou was at was this whole perception and this day-to-day working that didn't have the Christ thing. He was just a guy. He had a lot of problems. And what the reasons behind his suicide were many and complex. And I'm not sure that this person who wrote the Folio article, although there was undoubtedly a compassion involved or something, they probably had problems too that were other. The whole way that they reacted to what was going on at Pacifica that was bugging them was undoubtedly more than just Pacifica itself. And so the whole focus of the martyr-like thing, what do you have to give to keep it going, or what do you have to give to Pacifica? What does it require of a man? Does it draw out his blood or his guts or whatever? The whole thing is this perceptivity, just this day-by-day working out, you know, just taking a crisis as it comes. Maybe the station is going to fold tomorrow, okay? Maybe it won't. But just keeping on going and trying to be as creative, as open, as perceptive, as loving as you possibly can, and as clever, and so on. And all this is really what Lou Hill was. If he was just a suicide, you know, he'd be just a suicide. So what it requires of a person is, it's so easy to want to feel dramatic in this way, especially when things are really getting you down and you feel like your guts are being pulled out and the blood and all your real high-class energy is just so far in the past. It seems like, you know, years since you've woken up and looked forward to a day of really good work. But this is the time when it's so important. And Lou, for example, Lou had chronic arthritis of the spine, and he woke up with it every morning of every day. And he'd had it for years. And if they hadn't come along with cortisone in the late 40s, he wouldn't have been around to commit suicide in 57. He probably would have been dead in 1950 or something like that. So here was a situation like this, and somehow or other, he found some place in himself that he could draw upon just to keep going and face the daily routines, and when a crisis came, just live with the crisis, try to find a creative, open way to deal with it, and so on. And he probably made mistakes, you know, at times. And then there were a lot of other times when he was undoubtedly inspired by others, and times when he was an inspiration to others, because he found this place in himself a lot of the time. So this is what is so, so very difficult. I think the most difficult thing of all is to transcend the desire to see yourself in this dramatic light and have to find some kind of an apocalyptic figure, you know, or a dramatic thing like turning over society all at once, having all your problems cured all at once, just to be patient in the sense of just living with things the way they are in the essence of this poetic sensibility.
But the essence of the myth of Lou as a Christ figure has to do with something we haven't touched on, which is the gratuitous cruelty that obtains in an organization of true believers or of do-gooders or of people trying to do the impossible. And I experienced it, and I'm sure he must have. And the myth that had been distorted and transmitted to WBAI was that he was locked out of the station by an out-group or an in-group, and that this is what drove him over the brink, and this is what this person who wrote the article was alluding to.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Lou would have, the question that you asked, I'm not sure he would have said that was the essential question about why did these things occur, you know. I think the fact that it happened, for example, it happened in 1953 or sometime around then, that the same faction came and said, we can do a better job than you of putting a Pacifica station on the air. And at that time, what happened was that a number of people said, okay, try it. And they left the station to the other people for a year. And then the station, I guess it turned out the station went on the rocks and all that kind of history. They had a lot of trouble and lost an awful lot of subscribers. And then Lou and the other people were asked to come back. In 57, when the same people, probably in a more heightened state of mind and maybe more desperate and more unbalanced, came back and tried again to turn the station to a specific and selected viewpoint, Lou didn't any longer have himself, just due to the cumulative effect of the energy he'd been putting out, the arthritis, the effects of cortisone on his nervous system and brain and so on, I think he realized at that time that he didn't possess physically anymore the machinery to take this in stride.
Purgatory recapitulated. We walk by the old sun in the path of sheep scattering dung. Seeing is believing, and not believing is not to see. We must believe, just so. So with the ancient, slow fire scattering dung, we walk upward, departing our shadows, and take the planetary air. We must believe in the sanity of all creatures. Item, the digger wasps, legged, winged, eyed, armored, mad in the livid kingdom under our clod, whose sanity is our salvation. Or let us the little beasts, the singing beasts that live in our first ascent, those heron waters that are the hell and haven of birds, whose sanity is our salvation, let us believe. To believe is to hear, and hearing is believing. But somewhere very late, at the rock we breathe at, in the moment of the arid leaf laid on the rock, where we mount all the steepled day, whose movement is our salvation, we must touch to believe the thing believed in. In the movement of those equinoctial plunged leaves among our bodies, whose moment is our salvation, awaiting wind as we await nightfall and the heavy-thoughted dream that turns on the dreamer, we must be touched just so, so touched to believe we are the thing believing. Our lightest step on this hillside is the last step, but we are late, we can only go down like the sheep that follow the long shadow down to nightfall and a dunged slumber. To walk with dark is to dream, and not to believe is dreaming.
One thing or another, and all his problems seem to coalesce, whatever the reason, he took his life. But I think it wasn't a renunciation of the idea that there's just nothing you can do at one point, but just that there was nothing that he could do at that point anymore. That his body and his mind just were not his own anymore. And it was much more on an individual basis like that than a sort of a general thing.
In other words, KPFA didn't kill him.
No, I don't think KPFA killed him. Mm-mm. No, there was a lot more to him than that. A lot more different sides to all the things that were penetrating on him. And I think a lot of it was the physical side of it. Does that correspond to what you think, Dwight?
Did KPFA kill him? Kill Lou?
Not directly, no. I think it was certainly one of the factors that was involved, the repetition. There was a kind of squirrel cage. I used to think about it when our youngest child raised hamsters. And those poor little beasties would spend half the night going round and round and round, absolutely going nowhere, you know, on those wheels inside the hamster cages. I think this is what KPFA felt like for him at times, particularly toward the end, as though each problem that had been solved came up to be solved again with a slightly different cast of characters, and the feeling that very little was being done that stayed done.
Pacifica today would probably be unrecognizable on the surface to its founders, rather serious intellectuals who thought of themselves as professionals. They eschewed cults of personality and the atomized politics of access for the ideals of balance and openness. Pacifica of today would likely think the founders a bit stuffy, perhaps even humorless. Yet, there remains over the 25 years an unbroken thread. Joy Hill speaks of the early days of KPFA.
Lou had very little patience with dilettantism. And he was quite sharp about, at least privately, with people who had not a great deal of talent and less discipline, who, to revert to a poet who was mentioned in a private conversation recently, who had printed up his poems with some flourish and bad art surrounding them, etc. There was such a lack of craftsmanship that the man had not learned his trade. He was not ready to be published. It was rather like taking a 5-year-old's drawings and blowing them up and mounting in gold leaf framing them. You know, they were not that caliber.
Was the Mad Scene from Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, sung by Amelita Gallicucci in 1917.
The late Anthony Boucher with his Golden Voices, an original and very popular KPFA program that's still being played on Pacifica today.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to records by Amelita Gallicucci, chosen, in this case by Madame Gallicucci herself, from my collection of historic vocal recordings. Next week, we'll continue this series of 4 programs in all on Gallicucci with some further examples of her pre-electrical recordings, including some that I find quite interesting and important that she did not include in her list of favorites. Until then, good night.
You were the first program director of KPFA, then I guess of Pacifica, too, because that's all there was in those days. What was the station like? How was it organized?
Well, it was a very small staff, and actually the prospectuses, before KPFA ever was in existence, had the design of what they should be.
Eleanor McKinney.
That there would be 4 general areas, public affairs, music,
children's and then drama literature and so on. These would be, within this range, these were not limits so much as focuses of concern. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that that imprint that was structured there, still within all kinds of variations of content, still remains and has changed, you know, enormously over the years. One of the things that has concerned me, again, I have not been close to Pacifica, but that's happening in our society, and I think it happens there, is the breaking down. I think I mentioned it, we were talking, the Africans call it Kubili, which is the letter two, and different from one and three, it is the divisive. The moment you start, in that sense, getting two opposing points of view, then each of those twos fragments into two opposing points, and then into four, and so on. And there is no end to it. In order to represent everybody's points of view who has a political interest, it's just fragmentation to the end. There's never an end to it. And we, in that sense, Pacifica was not political. It was much more human, much more concerned about the human quality of life and experience. And it didn't, in that sense, give equal time to all the points of view. It presented responsible points of view in the political spectrum, but well-defined within that area. But it did not...
You mean within the humanist area? Or the...
For example, in public affairs, say, it was designed that all points of view would have representation, and did. And the range of those, and they were on at the same time every night over a seven-day period, or even over a month's period. So during that time, those people who represented certain political points of view were heard. But this did not mean that programming was divided into all kinds of positions in the society which are present today. It was much more a synthesizing rather than letting everybody speak his piece. That leads to chaos, and with no central focus and meaning about where you're going, and surely that's what human beings are concerned about.
Could it be said that the countervailing principle to Kabili or fragmentation would be a generalist approach, that every director of a department or every producer at the station was concerned, obviously they have their biases and they have their focuses of interest, but that they were all concerned with a generalist rather than a particular political program or cause or whatever?
I would say it was try to discover the meanings in all these, that it would be unitary rather than general. In other words, that the staff would work together in program planning to try to understand, say, philosophically, humanly, what all these things mean about where people are going and where they want to go and even where they should go. So that the staff was a unifying, exploring, discovering process, not people in their own departments working out what they wanted to do and fitting them all together, like a group of fragments fitting. We really wanted to explore what causes conflict. Why do we behave this way? Why do nations behave this way? What philosophies, what human discoveries have been made since the beginning of time that we can fruitfully explore together? Peace was a real meaning of Pacifica. It meant let us both reason together and explore together and even have compassion for each other in the process.
An ideal more often than it's realized.
What really is the ultimate effect of communication? What are we doing all this for anyway?
Joy Hill.
We are doing it so that each of us achieves some kind of empathetic awareness of the other guy, so that we are not so isolated, so shut off, so separated from one another by our lack of experience. This is the sort of thing that creates bigotry. We are, all of us, I imagine, to some extent, bigoted in the abstract. We're just not bigoted in relation to our next-door neighbor.
But people tell me every day they're not interested in talking to the average listener or all the listeners. They're interested in talking to their own people. And we've had instances in the early days of feminism where a group of women on the radio would say, we're not going to take calls from men. In fact, we hope men won't listen. And if we could control it technologically, we would talk only to women. What would Lou's reaction to that have been?
Well, I obviously don't know. It's absurd for me to say that I can guess what Lou would have said. I rarely knew what Lou was going to do from day to day. He was a constant source of surprise. It was one of the exciting things about living with him. I think, though, that you're dealing with a mass medium. If all you want to do is talk to a limited group of women, hire a hall man. There's lots of them available. We're talking about a group of people who have been licensed to use the airways to talk to other people. Now, what we were trying to do was to find a different way of talking, a way that wasn't implicit, didn't imply selling them something, that didn't imply manipulating them, that didn't, we weren't changing anything. We were just opening doors in people's minds. We were saying, this is happening. And what was happening, of course, you realize we weren't all that politically oriented either. There wasn't that much politics stuff, you know, on KPFA. We were also very heavily cultural. We were into drama and poetry and music and lots of marvelous children. One of the things that used to drive Lou up the wall was the quality of children's programs. We tried racking our brains, working very hard to do something really new and creative with children's programs.
And she saw the feathers come down, and she said, Bird, what's the matter?
Josephine Gardner.
Why are you shedding your feathers? The bird said, didn't you hear? Teddy Mouse is dead, and Teddy Mouse is weeping. The stool is hopping, the broom is sweeping, the door is jarring, the window's creaking, the bench is running around the house, the walnut tree dropped all his leaves. And I shed all of my feathers. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear it. I'll spill all the milk. And she did. She poured the milk out into the road. There was an old man up on a ladder. And he said, girl, what are you doing there? Why are you spilling that milk? You know your mother needs it. And she said, didn't you hear what happened? Teddy Mouse is dead and Teddy Mouse is weeping. The stool is hopping, the broom is sweeping, the door's jarring, the window's creaking, the bench is running around the house, the walnut tree dropped all his leaves, the little bird shed all her feathers, and so I spilled the milk. And the old man said, oh dear, 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 that's a great pity. I'll fall off the ladder and break my neck. And he did. And the ladder fell over against the tree, and the tree fell over against the house and knocked the roof in. And the roof broke the door and snapped the broom. And it all fell in on top of the three-legged stool. But Teddy Mouse was safe underneath the stool. She had to go find herself a new place to live. But she did.
There's no more striking difference between early Pacifica and the Pacifica of now than in the stylistic differences of on-the-air fundraising. What follows is a very early and ultra-genteel appeal for money done by Dick Moore, Lou Hill, and Gert Chiarito on July 5th, 1949, when KPFA had 237 subscribers.
Well, the thing that seems to me most important at this moment is help from the people who do listen to the station at present. And I should indicate that we are presently engaged in plans for what I call intensification within our primary signal range of acquainting people with KPFA just how it operates, what it costs to operate it, and so on. And I'd like to suggest that if anyone has at all the intention of supporting this present plan, why, I would certainly like to hear from each and every one of you.
Come on, people, 826-0880, 826-0880, area code 212.
WBAI Marathon, 1972.
The schlock on WBAI must be at least as worth as much to you as the schlock on the street.
Well, what about it? You gonna end it? You gonna end it now? You put me 4 minutes behind on my schedule. 826-0880.
Well, of course, it isn't too apparent, I'm sure, to our listeners quite yet just what plan we have in mind.
Well, I think one thing that we should do is this this sort of program, perhaps not as long as we've gone on this evening, but there should be regularly scheduled reports.
There are at least 334 people listening now. $271 to the end of the marathon.
I'd like to $271 point out also to our listeners the importance of their subscriptions, because I think sometimes they feel that their subscription is rather unimportant. But in my spare time from various other jobs, I attempt to do some of the bookkeeping at KPFA, so I come into direct
right now,
contact with these
subscription to WBAI right now will end the marathon. Instance, your call will end the marathon. You can end the marathon by calling right now at 826-0880. You can have the distinct honor of ending the marathon.
Or who had subscribed for 6 months in December, renewed their subscriptions, and over a week, I accumulated enough to pay the rent, which I think is very, very important, too.
$265 left in the entire marathon. Someone listening right now can end the marathon right now.
826-0880. Come on, there are seven empty lines on the switchboard.
And those things, I think, are vitally important for the listener to know, to realize that those subscriptions did something.
That's certainly true, and I think it ought to be added that
if we got 11 subscriptions, we would end the marathon. If there are 11 people out there who would take out a full year subscription, this marathon would be open.
We're going to be sending mailings out to various lists in the Bay Area.
826-0880.
Intensify air discussion and promotion of this whole problem and of listener subscriptions. And we're also seeking ways to reach the many different groups in the community.
When we were living up in the country, which was his haven and sanctuary, during some of those difficult years, and he'd come up Friday and go back down Monday, or with any luck at all, Tuesday morning early, up in Sonoma County, he wrote me a birthday poem one time. And there are a couple of lines in it that I think both illustrate what the poet's eye can mean and this particular facet of Lou. But these lines said, "And you were there, contesting with moles and fracturing the deliberation of spiders." I have never brushed down a cobweb since without fracturing a deliberation and apologizing. This kind of perception, this kind of openness, and I just don't have any words for it, really, is infinitely crucial. More today than then, even, it seems to me. Without getting into political things, and I keep coming back to this whole business of integrity, because it seems to me that what we are seeing is a kind of, and we all share some responsibility for it, a kind of summation, culmination of the erosion of integrity that has taken place since World War II. The profit motive has become God. And, you know, he laughed all the way to the bank, justifies everything. Well, we can't do that. It would cost too much, say the companies, when they are asked to clean up the water or the air. You know, Well, like, he can't do that. He can make more money doing something else. Sure, he can make more money. And this was, you know, the economic privation was part of the price we paid. And it was a real burden for Lou. And he did it with profound grace. I have letters of his that I treasure. When he was writing his dad for a loan over and over again during the years. Whimsical, gallant, heartbreaking, you know. It galled him. His father was a very successful businessman. Both his brothers were in the business. He was supposed to go back in the business. And here he was beating his head against this impossible dream out there, you know. The last Don Quixote of the 20th century, we hope, said his parents. And they'd already been through the disgrace of a CO son during World War II, and they just didn't understand it. But because this kind of effort was made, something was created that stood for something and continues, I hope, to stand for something. I don't know. I haven't been inside KPFA since the day Lou died. And this was a deliberate action on my part because nobody can dictate anything from the grave. And this was the end of an era. What every member of that initial group and initial staff put into it was what is so often missing now. It really, there was no self-serving. We were not there to become heroes. We were not there to become legends. We didn't do it to be famous. We certainly didn't do it to make money. We did it because it seemed important to the country to do it. It had to be done. It had to start somewhere. And this was a start.
You've been listening to Pacifica is 25, a celebration of the improbable 25-year survival of Lou Hill's brash experiment, listener-sponsored radio. This program has concentrated exclusively on the early days of KPFA. Pacifica survived the death of Lou Hill and went on to the great programs and titanic battles of the 60s. Programs such as Elsa Knight Thompson's Black Friday, This Little Light, produced by Dale Miner and Chris Koch, Dale Miner's The Battle of Da Nang, the great demonstration broadcasts during the Vietnam War, the introduction of freeform radio by John Leonard and Bob Fass, and WBAI's marathon reading of War and Peace. Among the great battles were the SISS and FCC investigations of Pacifica, Chris Koch's precocious trip to North Vietnam, the two firings of Elsa Knight Thompson, and uncountable numbers of strikes, coups, and all-night meetings. Thank you. Why, then, has Pacifica survived all these internal crises and external attacks? For two reasons, I think. Because Pacifica was needed by its listeners, and because a small number of people in each era were willing to risk everything, their families, their fortunes, and in some cases, their very lives, to keep it going. Will Pacifica survive the next 25 years? I think so, but not without equal struggle, and not without purpose and principle. 25 years ago, Lou Hill and his friends took a crazy gamble, that in crass America, enough people would voluntarily pay for what they could hear for free. He won that gamble, and all of us who've been touched by Pacifica Radio are grateful that he took it. This program was recorded in Berkeley and San Jose, California, Rochester, New York, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Technical production by David Rapkin. Associate producer, Kathy Dobkin. Special thanks to Eric Bowersfeld and Roger Pritchard of KPFA, as well as Peter Zanger and Richard Watson of WBAI. This is Larry Josephson, Pacifica Radio, Berkeley and New York.